The world of your brain and my brain, it's the most powerful organism in the known universe.
Sure.
Everything that happens in my world and your world is happening in the construct between our skull.
There's right.
This thing called our brain, 85 billion neurons, trillions of cells creating their own electrical and chemical reactions that I believe somehow affect not just our own body viscerally through feelings and emotions, but I believe that we are affecting this entire quantum field no differently than when a spider finishes spinning her web. She knows at the furthest end of the web, if anything's near it, she feels that vibration.
You're listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. This is your seat at the table. Welcome to the show. Today, Roland is talking with John Usaroff, who is one of the leading mindset and behavior experts in the world. John has built 5 multi-million dollar companies, been featured in blockbuster movies alongside people like Richard Branson and the Dalai Lama, and is currently the founder and CEO of NeuroGym.
Hey, this is Roland Frazier with Business Lunch, and we're here today with my guest and good friend, John Usaroff. John, thanks for being here today.
Hello, Mr. Roland.
You've had such a great career, and I think the first thing I really know about was the real estate stuff. There was a brokerage, and I think then Bamboo, and built up $4 billion in sales or something like that in the real estate.
Yeah, RE/MAX of Indiana took me 10 years to build, and we hit $4.5 billion a year in sales, about 25,000 transactions a year in Indiana.
So let's go back. Was the real estate agent thing then the very first entrepreneurial thing you did?
Yeah, being a real estate agent on commission only, other than working, in the pharmacy for $2 or newspaper routes or odd jobs, I never had a paying job. Okay. I had no idea. All I knew was, you eat what you kill.
Right. And did you say you left high school at 11th grade?
Yeah.
Nice. And
yeah, I didn't want to spoil my education.
I love it. So, so you did that. You got into the business. Now, did you find, what was it like being in business the first time that you remember? And were there any breakthroughs that kind of led you to think that maybe you wanted to be an entrepreneur versus working for somebody else?
Well, yeah, a few key things, as you ask me, pop into my head. My very first mentor, his name is Alan Brown. He offered me a job to work in his company on a 50-50 commission. So if I earned $1,000, he got $500,
right.
I got $500, which is normal in the real estate arena. Mm-hmm. First thing he had me do was learn the scripts. And so he had me learn cold calling, because mm-hmm. he gave me, a phone book basically, and says, okay, here's the list of the 50 homes around the corner from our office. I want you to call them and I want you to say, hi, this is John Usaroff with Alan Brown Real Estate. There's somebody that we have here who's looking to buy a home or you're interested in making a move. And if they say yes, I'd go to the script for here's what you say if they say yes. If they said no, I had a script for here's what you say
all
if
right.
you say no. And so I learned the script that I still can recite today, 30
I heard you go into it. Yeah,
years later. Right? And he also had a sheet of paper put in front of me that had 100 boxes in there. It says, now, here's the way the game is played. He says, box number one is worth $15, box two is $30, box three is $45, box four is $60, $75, $90, $105, $120, all the way through to $1,500 on the 100th box. He says, here's your job. You call 100 people a day and you use this script. He says, if you do that, I guarantee you do that every single day, you will become a successful real estate agent. Okay, I'll
right.
learn the script. I recorded the scripts on cassette tapes, and I listened to them every day on the way into work, on the way. I would memorize them,
right,
just
right.
like I did for my bar mitzvah. I actually recorded my bar mitzvah
That's
and
funny.
Listened to it over and over and over again, so I would commit it to memory.
Right.
First year working with Alan Brown, I made a total of over $51,000, of which he ended up getting.
And you're 18, 19?
I was
at this
19
point?
Years old. This was in 1980, and I made just over $30,000, $31,000 to be exact, my first year following this 100 calls a day script.
Which, you know what? I think today, to this day, $32,000 is the average real estate agent income. So you did that.
I did that
all those years ago.
Many, many
impressive.
Years ago. And I remember that number more because my father, as a cab driver, earned $25,000
oh, wow.
that year. And he had just bought his Grand Marquis hot car. And the reason I want to, you know, share that is I learned the value of following mentors and expertise, not opinions, but expertise. Start with what works.
Right, right.
And then, you know, I got, you know, I kept selling real estate, but I shifted over from his company where I was paying him 50%, or in some cases, he got to 40% of what I was earning. RE/MAX had just opened up in 1980 in Toronto and started to just have an incredible reputation there. And so in RE/MAX, their tagline back then was work for yourself, but not by yourself.
Oh, it's pretty good.
So I was like, well, you know, I just gave Mr. Brown the first year, you know, 20 some odd thousand dollars. The second year, you know, was like $70,000, and working for myself in a RE/MAX office was $1,000 a month. Okay. Actually, it was $700 a month back then.
Like a flat fee kind of
flat
thing?
Flat fee, $700 a month. Jeez, $700 a month. That's, you know, $8,000 a year.
Better than $70,000.
That's better than $70,000. And I switched over to RE/MAX, mm-hmm. and Indiana became available, and they asked me, you know, I was 26 years old. I was young, hungry, you know, do whatever it takes mentality.
No fear there. Just basically go ahead or blow through the fear and do it.
Yes,
right.
Yeah. No, there was no fear. It was okay. Like, move to Indiana. I don't know where Indiana was. Well, yes, I'll go. It made no difference. It was an opportunity, and I was prepared to do whatever it takes.
So then what do you do? What do you do to get started?
What I learned to do when I got started in real estate, dial for dollars.
Okay. So started following the playbook.
Just get on, you know, in sales, in business, it's a contact sport. And it doesn't make a difference if you're online, if you're face-to-face, if you're on the phone, if it makes no difference. The more people you can get in front of that you can pitch, whatever it is your product or service or solution is, and you have the objections wired down, you have, you know, the understanding of their wants, needs, pains, fears, frustrations, irritations, etc., and you understand how to lead them through that, which is like a New York script and a play that you can learn.
Right.
If you're really good at that, and you make enough calls and see enough people, or people come to your website or landing page or whatever it is, and you know how to present it in a way that gets people to say yes more than say no, then you're going to make some sales. And so I learned how to just pound pavement.
So you had to sell then not real estate at that point, but franchises.
I had to go and sell franchises now. And then I had to help the franchisees now, you know, become successful and recruit agents. And so I would do presentations to help them hire agents. And then once the agents started selling, we would get, you know, our monthly fee plus a 5% override,
okay,
you know, on commissions. And so the first year, I think I sold like 6 franchises. You know, second year, something like 12, third year, something like 18, fourth year, something like, you know, 16 or 18. And I end up with 85 franchises over the course of 10 years that were up and running and active. And we went from, you know, 47 agents to like 85 to 200 to, you know, 500 to 700 to 900 to 1100. And we ended up with 1500 salespeople in Indiana and 85 offices.
Okay. And were the franchisees that you were selling to, what were they like? What was the, what did you find? Like, I don't know if you saw the movie, The Founder, about the Ray Kroc thing. And he started out kind of looking at investors, and then he realized that military people and people that were going to actually work in the businesses were better. Did you have any discoveries or things about that?
So we knew that there are really, really good agents who make terrible franchise owners. And then there are really, really good agents who make great franchise owners. And the big key difference we discovered is the ones who are going to go and really recruit nonstop. When you buy a franchise, your game in RE/MAX is recruiting other agents.
Right.
And so if you're not going to go out there and sell, if you just think that, you know, having a franchise is managing, you won't be successful unless you have the selling ability. Mm-hmm. And so we honed in very, very quickly on who the top salespeople were that wanted to build a business and teach them how to divert their attention and energy from selling more real estate to selling people and coming to work for themselves at RE/MAX.
Were there like common characteristics of those people that were, that ended up being successful?
Yeah. The ones who were the hunters, where they wake up every morning and they think like, I got to hunt today or I don't eat. If you want the best salespeople in the world, find the hunters.
Okay.
You know, you find the one who they wake up every day and it's in their blood.
How did you identify this?
Well, first we would take a look at who were the most successful real estate agents in the state of Indiana, city by city, town by town. So that was pretty easy to get through, you know, looking at local newspapers, looking at awards, looking at all that stuff. And then we looked at, okay, who are these agents that also have offices that are successful? So we'd look at that. And our first strategy was, let's convert a mom and pop shop to a franchised operation.
Right.
And those were the hardest ones to convert because they had big egos. They were already doing well.
Okay.
And they didn't really see the value early on in converting their mom and pop operation to a franchised operation. But once we started, you know, advertising, you know, the benefits of RE/MAX franchises and the benefits of RE/MAX agents, they started to lose market share, you know, in year 2, 3, and 4. All of the legwork that I did in year 1, 2, and 3 to put them into my pipeline, they became my best franchisees afterwards.
Okay.
But initially, it was individuals who, you know, worked at other companies that, like me, you know, we're giving away $50, $60, $70, $80, $100, $200,000 a year to their broker, and their broker was driving a nicer car than they were, living in a nicer house than they were, taking their families on trips on the money that these agents were making. Those were the first, you know, 10 franchise owners that I got, people that were making a lot of money for other people that saw that, hey, they could do it for themselves. And then once they came on board, I started to pluck away some of the top people from some of the top companies in Indiana. Mm-hmm. And I always believed, you know, I tried to convert the number one company in Indiana. They laughed me out of their office. Tried to convert the number two company. They laughed me out of their office. But then I picked off the number one agent from the first company, and the number one agent from the second company, and the number one agent from the third company, and then a few of the people that came with them.
Right.
But I always started at the top, you know, and then worked my way down from there.
Makes sense. Were there any big breakthroughs that you remember having during that time before you exited that business? Anything that, and it doesn't have to be, but just anything that comes to mind is, gosh, I remember when this happened, it really changed the game, or it really unleashed the floodgates of business, or anything like that.
The game changer for us was radio and television and billboard advertising on a statewide level.
Okay.
So we had an advertising fund, every agent paid into, every broker paid into, you know, that we just kept collecting the money, waiting. And because RE/MAX International was creating all the TV ads, we didn't have to spend any money on creative. So we had been saving our money for like 5 or 6 years. And, you know, once we were able to spend like $1 million a year, you know, in a small state like Indiana, it was like, where did they come from?
Right.
So that was like a major breakthrough for us, because we ended up selling more franchises. More agents wanted to come to us. Our leads went through the roof into our offices. They didn't come to us. They went directly into our offices. But we were able to blanket the state with hundreds of billboards on the highways, thousands and thousands of radio and TV commercials. And all of a sudden, we were everywhere. Mm. And that was like turning on a light switch of branding.
Right.
But that was a big milestone. We can just flip on the switch. Our competition just didn't know what in the world hit them.
So when you got to the point where you decided that you might think about selling, what triggered the move out of that real estate brokerage into the next thing that you did?
I actually didn't think I was going to sell it. So the idea initially was, it was a cash cow, right? So every time a real estate agent sold a house, we would make a little piece of it.
Right.
And then we had 1,500 agents that were paying monthly fees. In 1995-96, when I took a look at my salary as CEO, when I took a look at my dividends from our profits, I was limited. So I was limited. Mm-hmm. I knew we couldn't grow much past that.
Okay.
I knew that, you know, my partners aren't going to all of a sudden, you know, give me $1 million or $2 million salary a year. Mm-hmm. I think I was making about $300,000 base salary at the time. Mm-hmm. And so even if I got an extra $100,000 as a salary, it just wasn't worth my time and effort to manage. That's not what I do well.
Right.
So in 1995, I started to groom one of our top office owners into being a regional manager with my partner's blessings. And then I transitioned out by 1997.
Okay.
And so I gave away my salary, of course, but I still had my monthly dividends and my quarterly distributions and my yearly payouts. and then I can go and do whatever I wanted in the world. And so I took a couple of years off just to explore, have some fun, you know, invested in a few things. And then another venture came around. One of my friends, Len McCurdy's son, invented this technology. And Len thought that would be, you know, great for us to do something together. And Len was a gentleman who had sold one of his companies for a lot of money. He had 5,500 employees he sold to IBM. And Len, you know, thought that his son had a really cool technology, which it ended up being a great technology. If anybody's ever heard of virtual tours, where you look at either a home in a distant land or a hotel room or a car, you know, using your mouse on a computer, that was Bamboo.
Right.
And it was also iPix, which is who we merged with afterwards. But that deal became available like in 1997, 98. And I had a chance to get in on that deal and also come in as a senior VP of sales and marketing. And so I moved from Indiana. I moved to a couple different places, Vancouver and then LA. And then this deal was in San Francisco. And so I just jumped on that bandwagon. And we grew that company from six people to about 1,414 months. Raised $28 million, took the company public on NASDAQ. And had another, you know, just killer run. We basically decided as a company, because of my background in real estate, we knew that virtual tours of homes are far better than pictures of homes.
Sure.
So we basically, we got, you know, deals done with Remax, Century 21. We got deals done with every one of the major companies, including Realtor.com. Mm-hmm. And so very, very quickly with the money that we had, we hired the right people, developed the technology more, you know, built a killer, killer team, and got in on the early days of the internet heyday. And nice. So I saw that, you know, go through the stratosphere.
Right.
And I saw it come down as well. Right. Fortunately, I cashed out with a little bit of money on that deal. It was 14 months of just pure entrepreneurial heaven and hell.
Right, yeah. Which is kind of the entrepreneurial journey,
Oh, my goodness. It's the thing about that deal that was just pretty spectacular is seeing what's really possible when you put amazing talent, time, and money together at the right place in history.
Right, right.
You know, it was just one of those things. It's like, holy mackerel. It's kind of like the stars, the moon, the earth, and all the planets aligned where you just open your eyes and go, wow. And for 14 months, I just about killed myself, you know, traveling the country. But that was a phenomenal entrepreneurial experience, one that has been, I haven't been able to replicate it yet, nor would I want to that pace.
Yeah, that's a pretty big pace.
And that's a lot more about lifestyle friendliness.
So that was a 14-month adventure. What was the, it merged into iPix? Is that what ultimately happened with
it? Yeah, iPix had a really good IPO, and we had a really good IPO. I think we went from like, you know, 7 to 17 in the first you know, opening, and we maintained and then climbed and they climbed. And then we had a meeting with iPix, and our investors were saying, why don't you guys just merge and just lock up the space and own everything? And initially it was, no way, we're Bamboo, they're iPix, and right. You know, we're their competitors. But it made a lot of sense. And so the meetings started, due diligence began, letters of intent were signed. And in less than 2 weeks from start to finish, we merged two $500 million companies in the market.
Pretty fast. You did the deal in 2 weeks?
That's
impressive. That's impressive.
Very, I mean, that's why I say it was iTime.
Right.
accountants, forensics, lawyers around the clock for 2 weeks, just nonstop.
Right.
Nonstop. It really showed me scale. Right. Scale, number one, was to scale to that kind of valuation, which really wasn't worth it.
Right.
In internet time, it was worth it.
Right, right.
To raise that kind of money on ideas, no revenue, raise $28 million, like, pff, try to do that now. not easy. Merge. When your bills are, you know, millions of dollars, and it's like there's no question that you can do it and do it, you know, it just showed me a new paradigm of scale. What's possible if you get the right people at the right time with the right backing for the right ideas?
Right.
What is possible? I was spoiled. I was spoiled freaking rotten, you know, having that experience.
So where did you go from there?
I moved September of 99, moved to San Diego, and then took 3 years to just be a dad.
Nice.
Raise my children, have some fun.
That's really great.
At the time, you know, I was single, had plenty of money to do whatever I wanted to, bought a nice home here in San Diego, and did everything that I wished I could have done when I was younger, didn't have the money or the knowledge
it's
or the the abilities to go that wild and crazy,
right.
But I did. And then in 2003, wrote my first book, Having It All.
What caused you to think about writing a book?
I want to share. I just wanted to
people give ask back. People You've been ask spending me, time with the kids, and you're probably thinking about that, right?
Yeah, give back. You know, share my journey, my story. And I mean, I never thought of becoming an author up until then.
And what was the book?
My first book is called Having It All, Achieving Your Life's Goals and Dreams.
Okay.
And it was all about, you know, how I learned to set goals and how I learned a little bit about the brain at that time, about the conscious mind, the subconscious mind,
right.
Setting goals, strategies, tactics, timelines, laws of the universe, some metaphysical stuff, some quantum physics stuff, and just my best interpretation of having a really great life. So can you have, you know, spiritual, emotional, mental, and physical health?
Right.
Can you make lots of money so that you have enough for yourself and your family and to give to the charities of your dreams? Can you have a great lifestyle where you're traveling and having fun and doing the things that give you joy?
Sure.
So health, wealth, career, business, relationships, fun experiences. I know you can have it all. And I also know that you have to believe that you can have it all, but then you have to create the environment and you got to upgrade your knowledge and your skills to be able to do it. And so it is possible. So I want to write about, like, here's some of the stuff that I've learned that you can follow. And I just want to share it with people.
So you wrote it. Did you have any connections in the publishing world or anything like that at the time?
No, I remember. My book was getting ready to be published in middle of 2003. And, you know, I wrote it myself and, you know, wrote it in like 90 days and getting ready to get it published. And I had sent it to a bunch of my friends to read. And one of my friends at the time was Jack Canfield, still a friend. I've known him for many years. I used to hire him back when in the old Remax days. Uh-huh. And so the day before I'm supposed to go to press, I get an email from Jack. And today I called my love letter from Jack. And it was like 3 weeks after I sent him.
And Jack is Chicken Soup.
Jack, yeah, created Chicken Soup for the Soul.
Yeah.
And, you know, very, very successful, you know, author, publisher. And so I get this love letter the day before I'm going to the publisher. It was a publishing company in Michigan, I remember. And it goes, John, hope you're doing great. Love you. Sorry it's taking so long for me to get back to you, but the book f-ing sucks.
Oh my gosh.
I said, what? I didn't even like respond to an email. I called him. I said, Jack,
of course, yeah.
I'm going to press tomorrow. He says, well, you can go to press tomorrow. That's up to you. I said, but the book f-ing sucks.
Wow.
I go, son of a. Why didn't you like get back to me 3 weeks ago? He said, I've been out of town. I've been traveling. So I remember going, all right, well, thank you, Jack. He says, I love you. I love you. Blah, 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 blah.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. And so I went down to the beach and I just sat and he gave me a whole bunch of reasons why.
Because my
book was very pragmatic. Set your goals. Create your strategies. Here's the tactics. Here's the timelines. Here's blah, blah, blah. You know, just very pragmatic, very military.
Written like someone who gets things done, which right?
And
just
he said to me, and he basically said to me, John, there's not one of your stories in here. There's not one deep story that you're connecting with the audience so they know you're real. So I had some health issues when I was younger and some ups and downs in business and drinking too much and, you know, all that stuff. He says, like, why isn't any of that in the book? So like, people don't want to know that. They just want to know how to get things done. He says, oh, no. You're missing
the story.
The story. And so I went to the beach and I thought for about 2 hours. And I said, okay, I guess he's right. I mean, if I'm going to call a good friend of mine who sold, you know, 100 million books,
I said, that's pretty
might as well take his advice, yeah. Right? So I called the publishing house that day. I said, hey, don't go to press tomorrow. And I called Jack back. I said, what should I do? He says, well, hire somebody to come and interview you. So he gave me the name of a gal by the name of Karen. And I flew her down like 10 days later to San Diego. She spent 3 days interviewing me from my childhood all the way up to that present day in 2003. Mm-hmm. And she got about 500 pages of transcripts, notes.
Wow.
And from that, she said, here's a great story. Let's put that here. Let's put that there. Let's put that there. Let's put that there. And so it took me an extra 3 months to get the book out. And then the book hit New York Times bestseller when it came out.
That's awesome. So you already had a publishing deal at that point, right?
No, I self-published.
Okay, you self-published.
I self-published that book. And I just did all the self-promotion also. So tell us
a little bit about that. What does that look like?
So I hired a... PR firm. We started a three-month campaign. At the time, you know, newsletters were just coming out. So I just started writing, you know, like newsletters of just content that I liked. Mm-hmm. I got interviewed on lots of radio, lots of, you know,
PR
television.
The PR company set up a lot of that.
The PR set all of that up. And just started a, you know, a marketing and sales machine.
Nice. That's pretty impressive. New York Times for self-published is pretty...
So I self-published, hit New York Times. And then people started, you know, saying, hey, do you do any events? And I said, no. Do you do any coaching? No. Do you do any... I was just wrote a book.
Right.
So from the book, I took the book and then I created my program called Having It All. From the Having It All program, I created a three-day event that I used to do called Having It All. From the three-day event, I got clients who wanted me to coach them and consult them. So I built a, you know, a pretty nice little business that I wasn't even in business. I just built a pretty nice business. And every 90 days, I did a Having It All live event for 33 people at $3,000 in my home.
Yeah.
In Rancho Santa Fe, which is, you know, where you live. And so I just started building this little business, and that's how it all began.
Now, did the secret come from that?
Yeah, the secret came from two things. In 2000, I think it's 8, 2007, Rhonda Byrne contacted me and says, hey, I read your book, Having It All. There's a great story in that book about the home that I had put out on in a Dream Homes magazine that I ended up living in that house, even though I had no idea that I'd bought my dream home that I cut out of a magazine five years earlier.
And she remember hearing that story when you did that. I was like, that is pretty cool.
Yeah. And so she had heard the story, and I was also part of a group called the Transformation Leadership Council that Jack Canfield started back around 2007, Jack and I were in a private mastermind group for about a year or two, and he came up with that idea in there, and I was like one of the first 15 people, you know, he invited to be part of this. And so Rhonda had contacted, you know, Jack. She contacted me, contacted Jack to see if she could interview some of the people in TLC at one of the meetings we were having in Aspen. And so she came with a film crew to Aspen. We had already agreed that I was going to be one of the people she interviewed. I think she interviewed like 30 people.
Sure.
We were in a hotel room sitting on like a chair with a green screen behind us, you know, one camera in front of me, her asking me questions. And she turned that interview from, you know, a hotel room, okay, into what a lot of people, half a billion people saw in the movie The Secret.
So crazy.
And so that gave me exposure, like, you know, there's no tomorrow. And because I loved TV and was pretty familiar with being, you know, on TV a lot or radio, I was one of the spokespeople, you know, for The Secret. So, you know, I got on, you know, Larry King 8 times, Ellen DeGeneres, all the major TV shows, radio shows, and then interviews for, you know, for magazines. And so, you know, I just kept sharing my stuff. And because I also had a passion for the science, that was of interest to a lot of people because I wasn't taking the airy-fairy approach to the law of attraction, which most people misunderstand and think it's some kind of, you know, woo-woo, airy-fairy, metaphysical, you know, sit, meditate.
If you wish for it, you'll have
it. Meditate, and all of a sudden there's going to be a knock on your door and the guy who gives the $10 million prize away for whatever that... That's not it. No. I've yet to see, you know, a car come down in a hot air balloon in front of somebody's house saying, hey, you've been praying for this. Here it is.
Right.
So, you know, I got a lot of exposure, 2008, 9, 10, 11, you know, 3 years of The Secret was everywhere.
I think they said they were selling 20,000 copies a day of it for a long time.
Just mind-blowing. I mean, they say over half a billion people on the planet have seen it.
That's so crazy.
So I got a lot of exposure out of that.
At that point, when you did that, so we're in 2008, the Having It All book, was that the only book you had done, or had you done a few at that point?
That was the only book I had done.
Okay, great. So what happens now from all of this exposure?
Just a lot of notoriety, a lot of invitations, a lot of opportunities, you know, a lot of, you know, so many leads coming to our website and phones ringing off the wall, which was great.
Was your interest in the science then, how do we get from there to NeuroGym where we are now?
Well, when this unimaginable event happened, when I cut out a picture of a dream home in a magazine in Indianapolis, 5 years before, you know, I moved into the house that was on the board, And I had no idea what city it was in, where it was in the country, how much it was. I was freaking just floored. How is this possible?
Right.
Like this makes no sense. A house like it? Sure. But...
And you didn't even realize that that was it until when? Until
my son had come into my office in the house that we were living in, and the moving company had just moved all of the boxes and furniture into the respective rooms of where stuff belonged. And I had bought the house in late 99, renovated it, moved in the beginning of 2000. So we hadn't even been in the house. And, you know, but I drove, you know, back and forth in the house quite a bit. I was renting a house on the beach in Solana Beach in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And so my son, Keenan, comes into my office one day and he's sitting on these boxes that are sealed that had been at United Van Lines storage in Indianapolis for 5 years.
Right.
And he says to me, "Daddy, what's in the boxes?" And I says, "They're my vision boards." And my son was 5 at the time. He goes, "Daddy, what's a vision board?" I said, "Well, sweetheart, when I have a goal or something I want, you know, to buy, to achieve, I put on my vision board." And he still didn't understand because he was 5 years old. So it was my vision board. It's my dream board. And he says to me, "Like, dream like when I'm sleeping?" I said, "No, sweetheart, let me just show you." So I pulled up the first board and it was, I don't know, 2 feet by 3.5 feet, right, something like that. And there's some nice cars on there and materialistic things that I wanted. And then when I pulled out the second board, smack in the middle of that board is a picture of the house I was standing in. And I, at first, there was disbelief in me. And my initial thought was, who's playing this trick on me? Who put this in here, right?
Hey.
And then I said, holy shit. Oh my God, we're living in the house that I put up on the vision board 5 years ago.
Right.
I was like, no way. And a tear started coming down my eyes.
I can imagine.
Because I had studied manifestation. I'd studied goal setting. I've studied a lot of stuff for many, many years. Right. I got involved in personal development at 19.
Right.
But it all came together in that instant. And it also left me with a lot of questions. How is this possible? How is it possible? So at the time, I started hiring quantum physicists, neuroscientist, molecular blah. I just started calling up experts anywhere in the world.
Right.
Says, "Can I hire you for an hour, two or three? I want to pick your brain. Here's the story. Share with me how this is possible." And this is really where I started to connect the quantum physics world, the field that we are in, that is the unseen world of electrons and protons and gluons and mesons, and thoughts that we cannot see, but somehow we are impacting this wave of possibility.
Right.
And so I just merged, you know, a little bit of the quantum physics world with this neuroscience world, because the world of your brain and my brain, it's the most powerful organism in the known universe.
Sure.
Everything that happens in my world and your world is happening, you know, in the construct between our skull, this thing called our brain, 85 billion neurons, trillions of cells creating their own electrical and neural and chemical reactions that I believe somehow affect not just our own body viscerally through feelings and emotions, but I believe through just my own research and understanding that we are affecting this entire quantum field no differently than, you know, when a spider finishes spinning her web, if she's at the far end of her web, she knows at the furthest end of the web, if anything's near it, she feels that vibration. She just feels that. And I believe that there is this incredible connection and interaction between all human beings, plants, animals, and that our brain is the electromagnetic switching station that tunes in or tunes out to different energy fields and frequencies. And when we hone in on a specific frequency and we lock and load on that like a radar, like a guidance missile system, we are activating the laws of nature way beyond our current understanding.
So what was the process? So you interview all these people and now what's next in the evolution of...
Yeah, so I ended up doing a business venture with one of my best friends that failed. It succeeded at first and then failed. We had a huge falling out, lost a lot of money.
Was it related to like brain science and stuff?
It wasn't brain science. It was actually business coaching.
Okay.
So we took the personal development arena plus both of our skills in business coaching, and we opened up a company in 2008-09 mm-hmm. Called One Coach. Mm-hmm. And we had thousands and thousands of clients, did really well. The market crashed. We switched from selling coaching and consulting to franchising.
Okay.
Started selling franchises.
Something you've done before.
Started to do really, really well. Mm-hmm. And then the market crashed. And he and I, our relationship just deteriorated. Not because the market crashed. There was some medical issues that came up for him that caused some serious challenges. And over the next 3 years, it was just a battle, just a wonderful lesson or many lessons in retrospect, mm-hmm. but very, very challenging.
What were some of the takeaways? Because one of the things that I'm a huge advocate of partnerships, and I know that you are as well.
I am too.
And you had great experiences with the people in RE/MAX and the Canadian partners and a few others. What have you learned throughout? Let's not just say that one, so we don't focus on that.
Sure.
But overall, what do you think about partnerships and how do you choose good partners and what are the potential pitfalls to look out for?
So I thoroughly believe in really good partnerships and I thoroughly believe that, good friends make good partners and good family members make good partners if they're, really good friends and good family members. So I think a couple of things is everything has to be in writing. No verbal agreements between friends or family or strangers. Everything has to be in writing. No handshakes.
And why do you think that is? Because a lot of people, I think, get the reason why confused.
When everything is great, there's never a problem. It's when things fall apart that amnesia or recalibration of agreements come into play. And all of a sudden rules change. Well, because you said this and didn't do that, or no, here's what we agreed to. It's in writing. And there were some financial decisions that my wife and I made to lend people in our company and partners money, and we didn't put some of it in writing. And when things weren't working well, basically we lost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So that was number one. Number two, very, very hard to have two co-CEOs. And my partner was a very, very strong CEO.
Sure.
And rightfully, he was a CEO of Indian Motorcycle. He took Indian out of bankruptcy. Oh, very, wow. Very smart guy. Very capable. It's really hard to have two CEOs. Mm. And, so we found that out quickly. Then we found out that even two CEOs that have different responsibilities within a company, like I did, sales, marketing, and product development. He did finance, legal, and other stuff. It's just really hard if you just don't agree on everything to divide a company like that. That's number one. Number two. Number three was buyout agreements. Mm-hmm. We had buyout agreements that were signed by me, never signed by him. Mm. Okay. And so unraveling the company just wasn't easy until my wife and I were financing it when times were really tough. Mm-hmm. And we just ended up throwing money into the company to finance it, to keep the company afloat.
Right.
I was blocked from being able to make any major decisions.
Would you do that again as far as the putting money in to keep it afloat?
Yeah. At the time, the mistake that I made, we brought on about $2 million worth of outside capital mm-hmm. from friends of ours, mm-hmm. mine mostly. And when I lent the company money to keep it afloat because Marie and I couldn't agree, I just kept lending the company money, at 7 or 8% interest rate. And what I should have done was lend the company money and tied the shares to that or dilute people where I could actually gain majority.
Sure.
And I didn't do it because they're friends.
Yeah, you were doing
They're dear friends. And so I don't want, the problem that I had with Murray shouldn't be their problem. But after, a year of it, 2 years of it, 3 years of it, it was my reputation on the line. Mm-hmm. And so that was really, really challenging. So I would just make sure, if we're going to play a big boy game, we're going to put big boy rules in place as well.
Right.
And everybody knows, what their downside is. And all of my investors were actually fine with it. Mm-hmm. And they appreciated that I didn't dilute them.
Sure.
But at a certain point, I'd put quite a bit of money into it. Right. It was like just wasn't worth anymore. I was losing my my motivation. I'd lost my motivation.
Right.
I had moved off from being CEO. Murray was kicked, off of the out of the company, and then we hired a management team to try and run the company while Murray and I tried to work things out because we had 80% ownership, and we just couldn't.
So this one didn't really take off, and now where are we in the scheme of time?
2011, 2012.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and then I decided to close One Coach.
Okay.
And so, database gone, client list gone, right. Everything gone.
Right.
Lawsuits from one of my shareholders, lost, my best friend, friendship until we kissed and made up, even though he had a stroke and is totally can't speak now. Oh. Can't use his right arm. He's totally incapacitated for the last 7 years, basically, which is really unfortunate. But had a lawsuit that lasted 2 years, another $1 million, down the tube that right. we ended up settling.
Those are never, I want to say those are just never good. Even if you're right and owed a bunch of money to me, it's just like,
I was right. And, but just, just money. The only winners there are the lawyers.
They are the only winners.
That's the only winners.
Agree.
Are the lawyers, and their job isn't to, to get you to a solution. Their job is to stretch it out as long as your cash continues. Anyway, so that set aside, I knew that, the brain, perspective, beliefs, emotional control, habits, this makes or breaks our lives. Mm-hmm. Whether it's our health, whether it's our wealth, whether it's our whatever it is, our brain is involved. And I have been fascinated with all the stuff that we've been learning about the brain. So we talk about, you need to have a great attitude. Okay. Where is that in the brain? Mm. You need to believe. Well, what's a belief? Mm-hmm. Do you have good habits or bad habits? Well, where are they in the brain? Mm-hmm. Let's say I have bad habits. How do I get rid of them?
Right.
Like, is there any science to let go of low self-esteem, low self-image, self-worth issues, fears, fear of success, fear of failure, fear of embarrassment, shame, ridicule? Is there somebody who could teach me that stuff?
Right.
Because what I found for me, and I've just been the litmus test and the guinea pig, is it's not a matter of not finding what you should do.
Right.
Okay, I mean, it's pretty easy today. If I want to know certain things that you're really good at, Roland, I said, Roland, hey, how do I do this? And you go, do this, 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 and that. Here's the book on it. Here's the videos on it. Here's the process for it. Here's the PDF for it. And here's everything you need. Do it. And then you hear things like, you meet somebody who you've given that to a month later or two or three. Hey, did you do that? Oh, no, I didn't get to it yet. What do you mean didn't get to it? Like, why?
Which is the majority of the people that you would give it to. We figured about 90%.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm fascinated with, if we have all of the how-to today that most people need, why aren't most people doing it?
What's the why not?
Yeah. It's like, why aren't you? So it usually will come down to things, it's happening in their brain. Mm-hmm. So either they're lacking motivation, and the question is, well, why? Well, it could be low self-worth issues. It mm-hmm. could be fears that are just deactivating the motivational center. It could be limiting beliefs, and it could be, self-doubt,
right,
which causes fear.
Right.
So I wanted to focus on, here are the real things that are holding you back from achieving your goals and dreams.
Right.
So forget about the fluff, but here's the real things. And that's when I started, my NeuroGym, and to give people a user's manual for their own brain. So if you want to use your brain better, mm-hmm. which is the most powerful tool in the universe,
right,
probably now is the right time for you to understand a little bit more about it.
Right.
Right. And so there's a lot of stuff that we've discovered in the last 10 years that we just didn't know for the whole history of our species.
So you have all of this amazing training and everything, and you do the Brainathon. Mm-hmm. For people who want to find out more about the brain stuff and all of the things that you've discovered, what's the best way for them to do that?
They can easily go to myneurogym.com, see what we've got there. We're putting, you know, newsletters out, you know, neuroscience newsletter every day, mm-hmm. just on a different aspect of either mindset, you know, or skill set, or, you know, emotional management, so you can break free from anything that's holding you back. Mm-hmm. They can follow me, you know, on my Instagram account or on my Facebook fan page. I do a lot of training there, YouTube as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's getting, John Assaraf?
Yeah, at John Assaraf.
Okay.
Yeah, John Assaraf. Or, mm-hmm. you know, we almost have duplicates of everything, the John Assaraf.
Okay.
And NeuroGym as well. So myneurogym.com is the website, or they can, you know, I have to redo my own personal website, which actually we just talked about this morning.
Oh, cool.
And then my newest book is probably one of the best ways to get into the deepest stuff. It just came out. It's already a bestseller. It's called Inner Size.
Okay. So I-N-N-E-R.
Yeah. I-N-N-E-R-C-I-S-E. Inner Size, the new science to unlock your brain's hidden power. And I say, you know, Jack LaLanne started the exercise revolution to build your muscles and your internal organ capacity. I'm starting the inner size revolution to build your mental and emotional muscles.
I love it.
And so inner size is some great, great techniques. And right now, for anybody who buys the book, we have a, you can get the book at, or get the all the freebies that come with the book at ignitemybrain.com.
Ignitemybrain.com.
And I've got 8 brain training audios to show people how to have less stress, how to stay more focused, how to be more aware, how to let go of disempowering emotions like fear, or disempowering emotions like you're not good enough or not smart enough or not worthy. There's a lot of amazing work now just on the activation or deactivation of circuits in the brain. Mm-hmm. And you know, when your motivational circuit's activated, there are neurochemicals that are released as well. And you know, a lot of these neurochemicals are our go neurochemicals, like let's go, we have
right.
motivation.
Right.
But we also have circuits in our brain that actually puts the brakes on motivation. Well, if you don't know how to activate the go neurochemicals
right.
and you're inadvertently activating the stop neurochemicals, you don't know what to do to get unstuck, you don't know what to do to get motivated, then it's just because you don't know how to use your brain better.
Right.
And so the good news is the tools are available. You can learn how to switch emotions, for example, like a Hollywood actress mm-hmm. goes from one emotion to another through some practice.
Right.
And so that's what the book's all about, is just unlocking people's potential.
So before we sign off, what would you say if you had one bit of helpful advice from all of the stuff that you've discovered in the field of brain chemistry and all of that to share with folks that you think could have a significant impact on them quickly, that's explainable quickly?
Sure. The rave right now is all around mindfulness or awareness.
Right.
Right. And so the question is, why is that the rage? And the answer is because awareness is what gives you choice, and choice is what gives you freedom. So we are operating at a subconscious level 99% of the time. We're just repeating these patterns and circuits and neurochemicals over and over and over again. Our brain becomes addicted to those patterns. And you have to stop the existing patterns long enough by being aware of them to change the pattern, so you're not in a reactive state most of your life and you're in a state where you can respond. And that is a practice. So meditation rewires your brain, and the gray matter gives you the ability to separate thoughts, emotions, behaviors, results, reactions. And mindfulness allows you to do that as well. And when you practice it, you're practicing neuromuscle work. So if you practice running every day, you're going to get better at running.
Right.
You practice mindfulness every day and meditation every day, you're going to be aware of the disempowering thoughts, the negative or disempowering emotions or habits that you have. And once you become aware, and then you have the skill of, well, if this thought pattern is not serving me, how do I change it? If this habit no longer serves me, maybe protected me when I was younger, how do I change it? Now you're much more in control and deliberate versus automatic. Mm-hmm. There is a whole lot of work on the brain on something called the default mode network, mm-hmm. right? And so everything, you know, that we build has default modes of operation, you know. So a circuit moves into its default mode, a computer goes into default mode. And the default mode is the automatic mode. Mm-hmm. We all fall into these automatic modes because of the brain's hierarchy of energy conservation is the number two priority of the brain. Safety, mm-hmm. number one. Number two is energy conservation. Mm-hmm. So in times of stress, we default to the automatic, not to the knowledge or the skill, to the automatic.
Right.
And so one of the keys to really expand who you are is become aware of all your automatic patterns and then interrupt them using brain-based techniques to be able to interrupt the pattern so that you can replace it with a more empowering pattern than before.
How do you recognize the automatic ones if they're automatic?
Well, that's where mindfulness comes in. That's where meditation comes in.
Okay.
But you can also, there's two intercises that I teach in the book, for example. So the first intercise is called Take Six, Calm the Circuits.
Okay.
So Take Six, Calm the Circuits is the very simple experience of taking six deep breaths in through your nose and breathing out through your mouth like you're breathing out through a straw. Mm-hmm. And the reason that this works is it deactivates the stress and the reactive center in the brain and creates a neutral baseline. So when you do an exercise to calm first, and let's say you're feeling anxious, or let's say you're feeling like, you know, you're angry, or let's say you're feeling like there's something not working, you know, to the way that you wanted. You do exercise number one, Take Six, Calm the Circuits. Then you do exercise number two, which is called AYA, A-I-A. So it's awareness. Okay. What have you been thinking about? So awareness of thoughts, emotions, feelings, sensations, and behaviors.
Okay.
So when you become aware of, well, my thoughts have been negative, my thoughts have been disempowering, my thoughts have been anger, my thoughts have been self-doubting,
right?
And the sensation that that's causing is not pleasant. And whenever you do an inner size like that, you do it in a state of no blame, no shame, no justification or guilt. Just pure awareness. So you're observing without judgment and laying any type of a name to it. It's just pure observation. So if you're aware of thoughts, emotions, feelings, sensations, behavior, and then you say to yourself, well, what's my intention? Well, my intention is to be positive. Mm-hmm. My intention is to be focused. My intention is to be happy. My intention is to be productive. Great. Then the last A is action. What's one action you can take right now to move you towards that?
Right.
So if you have, whether it's disempowering thoughts or disempowering emotions or disempowering behaviors or disempowering results, and you do exercise one and two, mm-hmm. all of a sudden you become aware of the pattern.
Right.
And then you make the switch. And if you do that often enough, you now reset the default mode network. Now, here is the good news, bad news scenario. Good news, you can rewire your own brain, and you're doing it every second of every day. Bad news, it takes between 66 days and 365 days to rewire a pattern that you've had for 30, 40, 50 years to a new pattern. Not 21 days, not 3 days, not 5 days. 66 to 365 days to change the pattern so that the old default patterns move out of the way and the new ones are the ones that are activated and run on autopilot.
That makes sense.
So all of the stuff that we do at NeuroGym is we get our clients, give me 100 days. Give me 100 days of retraining your brain, of innercising. We have the software for them and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But if you don't give me 100 days, don't come back to me and complain. Time. It's just not enough time.
Right.
When you understand the neuroscience, okay, so if let's say you're 50 years old and you've been alive, you know, 50 years times 365 days times 60 minutes in an hour times 24 hours, you're going to have a whole, you know, 300,000 to 400,000 hours of conditioning.
Right.
You can't unravel 300,000 to 500,000 hours of neural networks coding that's been created for the most part in 1 second or in one session.
Sure.
Some things take less time, some things take more. But on average, look at, you know, 66 days, 100 days to get a solid enough new foundation that thoughts, emotions, and behaviors change to automatic where it doesn't take any required energy on your part.
Right. That's awesome.
And that's why people, by the way, who lose weight, 99% of them gain it all back.
Right.
It's not that they didn't do it for 21 days or 3 weeks. It's not enough time to develop that new pattern.
Makes sense. Thank you so much for being here. And the book again is Inner Size.
Inner Size.
And the main website is MyNeuroGym.
MyNeuroGym.com.
Fantastic. Thank you, buddy.
You've been listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. If you're enjoying the show, let us know by subscribing and leaving a review. And for more information, go to businesslunchpodcast.com. Thank you for listening.
What if 3 days could change the course of your business in 2023? Get Scalable Live is where you'll gain great clarity on the next steps that will help you create the business, life, and wealth you deserve. Connect with business owners and entrepreneurs just like you, hungry for advice, proven strategies, and necessary connections to grow a business.
Literally, million-dollar conversations are happening in the hallways, in the bathrooms, across tables.
Get Scalable Live at Fairmont Austin, November 2nd through 4th. Tickets are on sale now at GetScalableLive.com.